Sash number 12778.
General Martin Reel 12.
There's bound to be, there's something fishy about this, he said. You're bound to find something. And so, of course, they open up the floor and there were all these arms. Well, I'm quite sure that he had heard so much or been so often to Misha Kagura escorting other famous generals. I remember him bringing General Dempsey on one occasion. I don't know what he was doing out there. That he probably almost believed that he had been responsible for that great find in the end. And I think that is the danger of where memory may take you. The tally of weapons found in this search was 330 rifles, 10 machine guns, 96 mortars, 5,000 mortar bombs, 5,000 grenades, and 500,000 rounds of ammunition. There had never been anything quite like it before in Palestine, and there was to be nothing like it again. Although in future, the battalion was ordered to send advisors with the search parties from other units when they did their own searches. There was a slightly macabre sequel to the search. The people of Misha Kagura were unable to believe that the success of the searches was due to the alertness and inquisitiveness of young soldiers. They decided there had been treachery. Two Polish Jews who had been thrown out of Misha Kagura some weeks previously for misconduct were hunted down, tortured and murdered. There was to be another operation of a different sort at the end of August 1946, known as Operation Igloo. And Operation Igloo was the transfer of the first lot of illegal immigrants, Jewish illegal immigrants, from the boats in which they were approaching Palestine to try and land to British-controlled ships, which would take them to detention camps in Cyprus. The first ship to dock in Haifa was coincidentally called the Yagur, which in view of the fact the battalion had searched Misha Kagura just previously, we thought was an appropriately named boat. It was a kike of 160 tons with a normal crew of about 12, and it held 758 refugees. As I said in the letter home, you cannot possibly imagine the conditions, however hard you try. The idea of being removed from the boat and put on one of the so-called Liberty ships, the Empire Hayward, I think it was, to go to Cyprus, obviously did not appeal to the immigrants, and they refused to leave. And so I was ordered with my company to remove them. And in my letter home, I say they fought like cats and like Glasgow gangsters combined, and it was quite a party. I can remember standing on the deck, on the wooden deck, with knife blades coming up through the planks from down below. And of course, the access was only down a little narrow companionway. And they had broken bottles, knives and sticks, and were clearly determined not to move. But in the end, we got them out the use of fire hoses. All this time, we were in the same usual way being told that we were worse than the SS and the Gestapo And as my letter home says, and worse than that, little old Hitler. But of course, Hitler would have just towed their boat out into deep water and sunk the lot of them. And by the time we'd finished, I felt that Hitler and I might have a lot in common. That was a rather jaundiced view, again, of a 25-year-old at that time. The occupants of Jagor were chiefly, as I said in my letter, thugs, Romanian army, deserters, etc. So that was a moment, a brief moment of excitement in what was otherwise principally a matter of patrolling roads, railways, and preventing blowings up. At the end of the year, I got leave home to England. It was a special end of war leave, and I think I had a solid month at home. And this was the first really sort of relaxed leave since the war had ended. But by now, I began to feel that I really couldn't face up to a life without excitement, and that the war being over, everything else was going to be anticlimax. Our new commanding officer, Dudley West, was a first-rate administrator, and for the first time, most of us realised that everything which one used, whether it be a rifle or a gum boots or whatever, had to be accounted for. If you lost anything, you had to pay for it. That everything had to be written down in books and accounted for. That there's no question of writing stuff off. And we were face to face with a hard life of accountability and administration. And it, knowing that Palestine was not going to go on forever, and not seeing anything else exciting in the wind, I decided while I was at home that I would apply to leave the army. And so I sent in my resignation, or request to resign, and had a sharp letter back saying that I would have to serve at least 5 years as a regular officer before I would be allowed to put in my resignation. So one had to face up to the fact one was going to have to go on. However, I had a quick leave, got back to Palestine to find that we had moved, that the battalion had to put down a mutiny in one of the administrative organisations in Palestine at the time. But it was otherwise engaged on patrolling the railways. I was by now acting second in command of the battalion, and I was sent before very long off to Tripoli, where the battalion was due to move. And so I went to the advance part of Tripoli to take over from the Gordon Highlanders, who were there. The day we arrived, one of their soldiers got taken ill with smallpox, and so we were immediately in quarantine. The Gordons, who had been having a very cheerful life in Tripoli, were not to be outdone by this quarantine business, and I recall that every night while I was there, I was taken down by ambulance to a restaurant in Tripoli called Romania's, where the ambulance parked on the pavement outside the restaurant. And the restaurant owner and brought food to us from the restaurant which we sat in it inside the ambulance. And it was a very cheerful business. But not very long after the battalion itself arrived in Tripoli, I was suddenly told that I had got to go on the staff, that in the interest of my career, it was high time that I had some staff training. And this was a terrible blow because I had been, it was now 1947, I had been with the battalion since 1939, so that was 8 years. It had been very much my home, and I had risen in it from being second lieutenant to second in command of the battalion. And I was now ordered to fly back from Tripoli to Alexandria to report to the military secretary's department. And I had a wonderful champagne breakfast send-off, but feeling utterly depressed, I embarked for Alex. And it really did seem the end of the world. When I reported to the military secretary's department, I was told, first of all, that I must take off my major's badges of rank, because I was now back to my substantive rank of captain. So that was one major blow to one's pride. And that I he produced a list of possible captain's jobs, staff jobs, which I might which I could choose from. And the only job which appealed me at all was to be acting G3 Ops, but acting G2 Ops of Headquarters 1st Division back in Palestine under General Gale. So that's where I found myself. And while I was there, first of all, the GSO2 was away on holiday, back in England having his end of war leave, and then the G1 was away. So I was acting G2 throughout the period there, which was only about 3 months. It was a period where we had a tremendous curfew operation called Tiger in Tel Aviv. It was a time when the two sergeants from the field security, sergeants Page, I think it was Page and Martin, were kidnapped while out on the town in civilian clothes. Hidden in a box underneath the floor of a garage as hostages for one or two terrorists who had been condemned to death by hanging. And when the hanging took place, were pulled out of their box and were hung on the spot inside the garage and were then carried out or driven out into the into an orange grove, strung up on the orange trees, and their bodies booby-trapped so that anybody who tried to cut them down would be blown up. And that was an incident which was described by the Times as being worse, or every bit on par with the worst war crimes of Hitler. And the chap who directed that operation was Menachem Begin. So that in after years, I always used to get a very uncomfortable feeling when he came to this country, as an East vet. It wasn't very long after, it's a matter of 3 months, on Headquarters 1st Division, when General Gale told me that he was about to be posted down to commander of Headquarters British Troops Egypt. And he had been asked by the military secretary's department down there whether there was anybody he would particularly like to have as his GSO2 intelligence. And General Gale asked me whether I would like the job. Well, it meant promotion back to major, and I felt immensely flattered that General Gale should have thought of me, and so I accepted. Before I went, General Gale had me in for a drink at his house, and told me what he thought was going to happen in Palestine. And he said as soon as the British pull out, then the Arabs will fall on the Israelis, on the Jews, and drive them out of the country, except for a little enclave probably around Tel Aviv. And that will be the end of the Jews. And how wrong he was going to be. So I went down to Egypt, to the headquarters of British Troops Egypt at Moasca near Ismailia, and I was plunged into the intelligence world, which I found extremely confusing. I had never realised there were so many intelligence organisations, all of whom appeared to be working against each other or trying to pull off coups without the other one knowing. And my job was to keep the commander of British Troops Egypt informed of what was going on in Egypt, to run an agent in the Egyptian army via the UK embassy and British embassy in Cairo, who was supplying details of the order of battle of the Egyptian army. Apparently we knew all these details perfectly well, but we were keeping him sweet in case we ever needed him to produce information which we really did need. But it was all sort of boys' own paper stuff, and I used to go up once a month, heavily disguised in plain clothes, to Cairo to meet somebody from the embassy at some restaurant where an envelope would be passed across to me, which I was told gave the latest disposition to the Egyptian army, and I used to pass across an envelope containing a certain sum of money, unaccountable. Anyhow, I didn't really enjoy this terribly, and then out of the blue I got a message saying that I was going to be instructed at Sandhurst, the RMA Sandhurst, and had to be back in England in about a week's time.
When was that, that you were running the agent in Cairo?
This was November, December, October, November, December, 47.
And what was the official position that you held then?
GSO2 Intelligence, General Staff Officer, Second Grade Intelligence. Headquarters, British Troops, Egypt. My main task, in fact, was to produce a funny story for the monthly intelligence summary about King Farouk. I'm afraid I can't remember any of them now, but it was expected that every summary would have a tailpiece, which would be the latest gossip or humorous story about King Farouk. So, anyhow, I got this posting to Sandhurst, and I came across the telegram which I sent home the other day, informing my mother and father that I was coming home, which was in verse, and read, "My service in the Middle East has somewhat prematurely ceased. If my hunch turns out a winner, should be home for Sunday dinner," which then, not of the highest poetry, was, I think, showed how delighted I was to be coming home.
I think the next operations you were involved in were Malaya. Can you tell me how you came to be involved with that, please?
Yes, after 3 years at Sandhurst, a year at Staff College, a couple of years as brigade mate of a TA brigade, and then a further couple of years as chief instructor at the machine gun division of the School of Infantry, I find myself back with the battalion, now called the 1st Battalion, although it was in fact the 2nd Battalion renamed, which was then in Berlin. And this was in 1956. And I spent 9 happy months there, eventually getting back to the rank of company commander again, having had first of all to start as second in command of a company. And then we moved from Berlin at the end of 46, and 56 rather, and came back to England for a brief spell at Barnard Castle, presentation of new colours by the Queen at Chester, and then off to Malaya in at the end of July 1957. I went out as part of the battalion advance party. We flew in an appalling aircraft, which I think was called a York, which took 4 days from Blackbush Airport near Camberley until it reached Singapore. During that time, and in those days, one had to put down for all main meals. We were unfortunately 4 hours late leaving, and so we were out of synchronization for all meals at all the places we put down. We arrived at Brindisi, where we should have had supper at 2 in the morning. We should have flown on immediately after supper, but couldn't, because by that time the crew had run out of flying hours. So we had to spend the night lying in corridors, and then I slept in the baths in one room. And then we put down at Ankara for lunch next day, long after lunch had finished. And it went on like this until we eventually reached Singapore. We then went on a 3 weeks course at the Jungle Training Centre at Kota Tinggi, which was our introduction to leeches, and it was a very, very good course. I've always had a horror of creepy, crawly things, and had imagined that I would hate the jungle. But I found that I took to it straight away, just as I had taken to the desert. Being somewhere apart from people, where it's very much you against the elements or against the environment to survive, it was very, very hard work, very stamina sapping because of the great heat, and because of the very slow movement. If one in the desert, if you travelled 25-30 miles in a day, that was quite reasonable going. In the jungle, if you travelled 400 yards during a morning, you had done pretty well. So one had to get used to a completely new time scale. And that was quite apart from the fact that there were terrorists in the jungle who you were hunting for. So after 3 weeks, the battalion had arrived out by sea in the meantime, and they then came down to Kota Tinggi, and we trained the whole battalion as our own instructors in the art of jungle warfare before going up country to our operational station. The battalion had been given an area around Sagamet in North Johor. My own company took over from at a rubber plantation called Bukit Serambang, not far from Mount Ophir, from 2 companies of the Rifle Brigade. The 2 companies of the Rifle Brigade were commanded by Major Dick Worsley, later General Sir Richard Worsley, who had been an instructor with me at Sandhurst, and Major Frank Kitson, later to be General Sir Frank Kitson, and already famous for his exploits in the Mau Mau engagement. I spent 3 weeks living with Dick and Frank Kitson in their company mess in Bucket Serampang, and trying to learn how to operate a company in the jungle from them. They were both completely different people, and the one I found the more fascinating was Frank Kitson. Every evening he would retreat to one corner of the anteroom, the so-called anteroom in this old rubber planter's bungalow in Bucket Serampang, surrounded by tin huts in which the soldiers were living when they went out in operations. And he would retreat to one corner with two folders, one blue and one pink. The blue, if I remember rightly, contained the photographs and full descriptions of all the remaining communist terrorists in the companies, in the operational area of the two Rifle Brigade companies. And Frank used to sit there and look at photographs and study biographic details for clues as to how these people might be operating, where they might be, trying to get some sort of feel about them, so that he could work out where they were likely to be hiding in the 360 square miles of jungle, which was the company area. The other folder, I was told by Dick Worsley, contained, although I never saw it, contained photographs and particulars of a number of girls who his mother thought that were suitable candidates for marriage on his return to the United Kingdom. But whether this story is true, I had no means of checking. He certainly did get married after his return. But it was a fascinating experience learning from him how to operate. And the Rifle Brigade had become adept at running what we call tiger patrols. That is, patrols of about four men operating very lightly clad and equipped from jungle bases and deep inside terrorist country. So whereas in previous days soldiers had gone in to the jungle from their main bases every day and then come out again the same night, now people lived in the jungle for up to 3 weeks or a month, deep in, having got either carried their supplies in with them or had them dropped by aeroplane, and operated small patrols from there. If something could be done, because there were so many fewer terrorists now around.